You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only shade of gray we recognize is number 35, Jonas. Recently, during an appearance on the Supernauts podcast, I said that Ayn Rand thought homosexuality was a disease. Her statement I was making that inference from was during a Q&A. I quote, "Because it involves psychological flaws, corruptions, errors, or unfortunate premises, but there is a psychological immorality at the root of homosexuality." The words I was keying in on were flaws and corruptions. They seem to imply not a physical, but a psychological disease. It's a difficult interpretation. Regardless of what Rand actually believed, the broader point I was making remains. I don't care if she held incorrect beliefs and was mean, rude, vindictive, or whatever label you want to put on her personality. Her personal applications of her philosophy don't undermine her philosophy in the same way that Tom Brady wearing a Yankees hat at a press conference doesn't affect his status as the greatest quarterback of all time. Joining me today, via Skype, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
So are you saying that Ayn Rand was the greatest philosopher of all time or the greatest quarterback of all time? I was confused.
Well, I said his status as the greatest quarterback of all time, which means that unless Ayn Rand was secretly also a man, that I was clearly referring to Tom Brady as the greatest quarterback of all time.
Okay, just making sure.
But yes, by implication, you pick something up. But I don't want to make that explicit.
Oh, okay. We wouldn't want to. You, of all people, wouldn't want to make anything explicit. So.
Well, you know I like to be subtle sometimes, and people tell me to bang people over the head with things, but I'm going to be subtle this time.
You be subtle. It's all right.
Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. How are you, Elliot?
I'm feeling flawed and corrupted. But not for my homosexuality.
For what reason?
Just exhaustion. Work. We don't have to get into it.
All right, then. Let's not. Let's talk about some people who have no idea who they actually are. It's time for The News with Daniel T. Richards.
Mark Zuckerberg is a sexist, and by implication, so is Michael Jordan. And by implication, so is anyone who has ever worn a gray shirt. At least that's according to New York Magazine's The Cut blog. When asked recently about why he wears his trademark gray shirt every day at his job at Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg answered, "I'm in this really lucky position where I get to wake up every day and serve more than a billion people, and I'd feel I'm not doing my job if I spent any of my energy on things that are silly or frivolous about my life." That's what he said. This is what he apparently meant, according to New York Magazine. "Burn, Zuckerberg. Is it just me or is the mindset of the Silicon Valley power schlub?" That's right. They called him a power schlub. "Imply that caring about clothing or how you look invalidates your ability to work. Of course, male CEOs are far too focused on changing the world or building the next big app to care about something as silly or frivolous as dressing professionally. They'll just leave that to Marissa Mayer." She's the female CEO of Yahoo.
Oh, thanks for explaining that for me, because when you talked about a woman, I didn't care what she did.
Exactly.
So here we go. I just want to know, does this make Doug, the cartoon, a sexist because he wore the same thing every day?
I think so, because apparently he was mocking women who think that dressing nice isn't silly or frivolous.
At least we finally know why Patty Mayonnaise didn't want him.
Hey, Doug is racist, not sexist, because they had a green skin character, Roger. Well, obviously a slam against alien Americans who come from other planets. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So just saying.
Now, there's enough social justice to go around. Doug could have been both racist and sexist.
That's true.
Also homophobic. Because that whole underwear on the outside thing.
Yeah, Quail Man.
Yeah. I don't get this. Not in my usual I don't get this feminist thing kind of way. What do they want exactly? Like, what would have been an appropriate answer that would not have pissed off a feminist? I honestly cannot think of a single thing he could have said that would not have pissed them off in some way.
All he had to say was, it's just what I like to wear.
Oh, well, why don't you like to wear more non-androgynous, more feminine things? Do you always pick this sort of semi-male stereotypical wear? Is that because you're hetero patriarchal centric, Mark Zuckerberg?
Fine. My wife picks this out for me.
That's not bad, except just one wife, Mark Zuckerberg? Why is it only one woman good enough for you? Why can't you have more than one woman? And this whole marriage thing, you think she has to pick out your clothes? She your slave? Do you just use her for sex and clothes picking out?
Terrible.
My wife forces me to wear this.
Again, your wife? You think you can hold her in bondage just because you put a ring on her finger? Who are you to say that she can't sleep with any man that she wants?
The woman who forced me to marry her forces me to wear this.
I love how Justin is just running through options. Like,
I think you see that this reduces to nothingness.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the ultimate point, is they're always going to find a reason to be offended. If you go into something looking for problems, you're going to find problems. If you go into something looking for things to be excited about, you'll be excited. For instance, I think it's pretty cool that he's so focused on his work that he doesn't care about fashion.
Right. And notice, he doesn't say anyone who thinks about fashion is an idiot or something to that regard. He says, in my life, I don't want to spend the energy on these things because I have a job that serves billions of people.
Yeah, he's completely focused on himself. He's not other-centric at all.
Right. But I think your point is quite good. These critical theorists, these people who want to apply Marxism or feminism or queer studies or whatever they're calling it now to every single situation, because they want to apply it, they're going to find it in every situation. They're not actually going to look at evidence in the world to find real, genuine sexism or real, genuine misogyny. They're going to find it in everything anyone says or does.
To apply a little grad school theory to counter their grad school theory, that's their screen of looking at the world, and because of that, they turn the things they're looking for into faceless problems. So everyone does them. So it's not about certain individuals. It's just this idea that exists that is impossible to defeat because it's not grounded in anything. It's faceless.
Exactly. And we hear it all the time, not said in that way, although I think that's a much more clear way of saying it, but in the whole concept of it's systemic, meaning we can be racist and sexist and misogynist even when we don't intend to be, even when we don't think about it, even when we're just putting on gray t-shirts. We're racist and sexist.
We contribute to rape culture and we don't even know it. That's basically what it has come to now. You're a rapist just from walking out your front door in the morning.
Right. That's why it's faceless, because it's every person who fits a certain criteria.
Having a penis,
being a certain skin color, supports it, or even if they don't mean to. The other instance that's majorly with this is white privilege. We saw that with the response to the catcall video, where they made the white privilege video, where they exaggerated it by making it seem like being white and walking down the street made it so everybody just gave you anything you wanted.
Yes, exactly. Oh, frankly, I wish that was true. I could use a Starbucks right now.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could just walk down the street and people were like, here are Patriots tickets. Okay, that'd be pretty awesome. But that does not happen. Even my parents sell the tickets to other people.
That's awesome. Speaking of nameless, faceless people, there's the internet, which is apparently filled with them. And in fact, a recent study by the Washington Times showed that of the 226,838 comments on the official Obamacare website, 60% of them were attributed to fewer than 100 unique profiles. This, of course, has many implications for the quote-unquote popularity of the Obamacare website online. Basically, that it's not at all popular, but it's in fact about a core tiny group of people who are creating a lot of activity to make it seem as if it's popular. And they interviewed one woman, Cindy Hung, I cannot pronounce her name. She's an Obamacare supporter in California who on average posted 59 times a day on the site, making her the number one poster in that period, and she posted only during work hours and never on weekends. And she has four separate unique profiles to post on the website.
Four separate Facebook profiles?
Yes. At least four. That she confirmed.
This is where we have to go back to Michael Bay, which is going to piss off all these anonymous people anyway. He just says it's the same 50 people on the internet. Isn't this more proof of what he's talking about?
I think it is. I mean, I sort of always expected that this problem was there, but I wasn't entirely... I couldn't confirm with data that it was this bad, certainly.
I just love the fact that they say, oh, we're not a cult. We're not a cult. We're not a cult. Yeah, you're a fucking cult, dude. I'm sorry, but 56 times a day during work hours, but not on weekends. Goodness forbid. I'm sorry. That's cultish level. Like, we're going to go to her house and we're going to find, like, a big old statue of Obama on her mantle with candles all around it and, like, a dead cat sacrificed. I mean, that's
just for good measure, a dead cat.
Just for good measure.
Yeah, but we can sit here and we can, you know, say this is the Obama cult, but this sort of behavior is not limited to Obamacare by any means. This is just what these people are fixating on. You go to any website on the internet and it's filled with people doing this. They're just obsessed with a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just speaking in this context. I just find it funny. That's all. Of all the things in the world to obsess over.
And I mean, all the people have said that they were not paid to do this, that they are just supporters of this bill and they want it to be successful. So here's a counterexample for you, Justin, which is Paul J. Newley is an anti-Obamacare poster who made 2,316 posts in 16 days, ranking only behind Miss Young. He's a retired veteran from New Mexico who said he wanted to rid the site of misinformation.
Did he only have one profile, though?
He only had one profile, yes.
Now, look, I think that's unhealthy in itself, but at least he only has one profile. I think it's an extra level of unhealthy when these people create multiple profiles to make it seem like people agree with them and to make it seem like what they're doing is more important than it is, because it's using social bullying and peer pressure when there is none. It's the appearance of it. There's a certain level of twistedness when nobody agrees with you, so you create fake identities to agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. One interesting aspect of this story that doesn't relate to the weird cultish behavior of people who live online. Did you know that the Obamacare webpage and President Obama's Twitter account is handled by Organizing for Action?
Yeah.
Which is just his former political action committee and now is a nonprofit group?
Yeah, OFA. Obama for America, now it's Organizing for Action, but it's the same people.
Doesn't that seem, if not illegal, really sketchy?
Definitely.
Is that just me?
No, it's definitely sketchy. I don't know if it is illegal.
It's not illegal because as a society, we haven't learned how to deal with the internet yet. And I know that sounds ridiculous because it's been a major part of our society since at least the 90s. But the fact that we're still dealing with this, that Facebook still has no mechanism for controlling all these fake profiles, the fact that people still make all these fake profiles and they're on Twitter all day and Facebook and commenting on news articles, and that, you know, this thing you just pointed out with Obama's going on, it shows that we as a society have not accepted this as a normal part of life and learned how to deal with it yet. It just exists and people just do whatever they want with it. And I'm not claiming there should be government regulation. I'm just saying, in the same sense that you learn how to deal with other parts of society, like interacting with people, Now you have to learn how to interact with people online. It's a discussion people need to have with each other and with themselves.
And net neutrality is not the way to handle it, by the way.
Yeah, fuck that.
Just saying, I'm going to throw that out there.
Fuck anyone who thinks that net neutrality is the way. I'm tired of having this argument. I've had a legitimate sort of peaceful discussion about this for years now. And the fact that the people still think it would be a good idea for the government to regulate the internet as a utility just need to fuck off and die. I'm tired of it. I'm done. Mm-hmm. I'm done. That felt good. That was really cathartic. Thank you, guys.
That's good.
So speaking of people not knowing how to deal with each other, in Canada, of all places, there's a campaign at a university that recently really pissed people off. McMaster University recently held an event called Hug a Terrorist, which brought out children, Palestinian children, and dressed them in traditional garb with signs that said, "Hug a terrorist," in quotes. And the other side of their sign said, "Do I look like a terrorist?" This, of course, was meant to bring attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the fact that children on the Palestinian side are being killed in Israel's evil bombing of their very peaceful and completely non-threatening country. Because Israelis just have these fangs out and they want to suck the blood of children. And I think that's it, but you get my point.
Hug a
Canada!
I'll strap a C4 belt to him.
This is Canada, people.
Worst part of this story. Do you want to know what the worst part of this story is?
The writing?
That's just a given at this point. As a writer, I can't read anything without getting angry. But it's. I'll give you a hint. It's linked to the previous story.
Oh. Please. What, now I wait with bated breath.
No, not the comments. Did you see where they got this idea from to do this at this school?
No, I must have missed that part. A YouTube video?
Yeah, there was another event at a college that they saw on a YouTube video. And that's where they got, well, maybe not on a college, but it was another event they saw that they did this, and they just replicated it. So this wasn't even an original idea. This was just, hey, they did that. Oh, that seems clever. Let's do it. So again, not understanding how to use the internet. If you wrote a paper based upon what you saw on the internet, that would be plagiarism. But doing the same thing somebody else did and getting news coverage and thinking you're original and clever and you do it? Come on. It's a stupid, offensive idea, and then you steal it from someone else, which is even dumber. So you take a dumb thing and you do it in a dumb way. It's just...
It's interesting. I think the part that fascinates me most is that this was originally supposed to be scheduled for the day where the Islamic terrorist shot and killed someone in Canada, and they had to reschedule. So there's that.
Did they actually have to reschedule for the right reason, or was it just a coincidence they had to reschedule?
No, they said they rescheduled because it would be a little poorly timed if they did it that day. So they did it the next week.
Oh, so they actually thought with their brain.
As opposed to thinking with their YouTube.
Yeah, I'm just amazed they were able to recognize something in reality, see the way it's similar or different from another thing in reality, and make a decision based upon that, rather than just stealing ideas from the internet and replicating other things.
Yeah.
Nobody who thinks taking little kids and using them as political pawns and pretending they're terrorists is a good idea is smart, okay? They're little kids. It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard about. It's just so offensive.
I mean, the idea, first of all, hugging a terrorist, that is a pernicious idea. If that's not bending over for Islam, I don't know what is, for one thing. The idea that, because this is reinforcing the idea that terrorism is a racial issue. It's not. It's an ideological issue. If the kid is saying, oh, do I look like a terrorist? Well, I don't know. Do you subscribe to a religion that advocates cutting people's heads off, hanging them if they're gay, letting women burn to death in houses rather than run out of the house without their faces covered? If so...
So you're saying they're trying to make their women faceless.
Basically, yeah, literally. Literally.
I had to work the theme in there.
Right, you could have used a throwing acid as well. This is all ridiculous. The whole Israeli-Palestinian thing, I don't think I'm expert enough to get into, but the idea that you honestly believe that Israel is targeting these children, or that even they don't care that they're killing children, and that it's completely Israel's fault, you're not being honest. Like, it's a complex issue, and I'll give them that, but you're not being honest if you're putting this all on one side.
You're completely assuming ignoring, they've run it through that much.
Just, I don't even care. I guess you're right.
We have our Canadian listenership needs to take care of this.
Yeah.
Canadian listeners, go find them, smack them, smack these people. And
go to McMaster's and smack a terrorist.
Drew.
And I don't mean the children. I mean the people who did this are terrorists.
Yeah. Smack them.
Yeah. So speaking of things that haven't been thought through, fast food. Apparently, fast food companies are targeting black kids in America. Now, that's a pretty sensationalist title, one you'd probably find on the Huffington Post, except this is from the AFP, which is supposed to be a very reputable news source out of France.
You just said reputable out of France?
Well, yeah, the AFP is supposed to be like the Associated Press, but of France. And,
that's assuming the Associated Press is reputable.
So the headline is Fast Food Targeting Black Kids in U.S., which just conjures a picture of, like, Ronald McDonald waiting to cap someone's ass.
It's the sixth season of The Wire.
Or, like, the Hamburglar out there with a billy club just beating black kids upside the head.
Well, they had that cop character, didn't they, with the billy club?
The Hamburglar?
No, there was a cop character who tried to catch the Hamburglar.
Grimace?
No, there was a cop character. Google it.
There was a cop character in McDonald's folklore.
Yes.
So he, like, reported to Mayor McCheese?
He must have. Hold on, I'm going to Google this. You keep talking about this story while I Google it.
Okay. The AFP reports fast food restaurants in the United States are disproportionately targeting black children and kids in middle income and rural areas, according to a newly published study. Newly published studies basically can say anything you want them to say. Researchers at Arizona State University and the University of Illinois at Chicago looked at 6,700 fast food outlets nationwide to check the extent of indoor and outdoor marketing aimed at youngsters. Quote, majority black communities, rural areas, and middle-income communities are disproportionately exposed to child-directed marketing and specifically to indoor displays of kids' meal toys, a popular strategy among chain restaurants. The study said, in light of these findings, it's important to urge the fast food industry to limit children's exposure to marketing and promotes consumption of unhealthy food choices. How about, in light of these findings, it's important for parents not to be shoveling French fries down their children's throats? Anyone?
That's hysterical.
I don't understand. Marketing is not Ronald McDonald putting a gun to your head and saying, jam this nugget in your kid's ear. Or down his throat. Whatever. It is persuasion. It is saying, look at this delicious food. Don't you want to buy it? You can say, and I know this is going to be shocking to most people listening, you can say, no, I will not do that. Or I will only do it once a month, or once a year, or once every 6 months, or never. You have the power. The power is yours. I don't understand. Did you find the cop character, Justin, or are we just going to buy time until you do?
No, I was about to interrupt you and say, on to more important matters. So the cop character's name was Officer Big Mac. He was dressed like a cop, except his head was a Big Mac. And if you remember in the play place, they used to have a jail cell you could go into. It was round, and the top and bottom were his head with the cap on top of it.
So are you saying Mayor McCheese hired his nephew to be the chief of police?
Yes, they pretty much look the same. It actually says that on the Wikipedia page.
And so there was corruption in the McDonald's government?
Yes, to the fact that they were sued. There was a lawsuit, and Mayor McCheese and Officer Big Mac were discontinued because they were ripoffs. Apparently, Mayor McCheese was, by the U.S. court, was labeled a ripoff of H.R. Puffin stuff.
That sentence doesn't make any sense to anyone born after 1970.
Learn your history, kids. Look that up. But no, I have a take on this story that I want to make a point of.
Oh, please.
So this may seem racist, but it's not. Which is always the best way to start a sentence.
Yeah.
Could this marketing not have to do with race, but income?
Well, yeah.
They're not targeting black kids. They're targeting people from lower incomes.
I would say that's likely true. I mean, it starts with major black communities, rural areas, and middle income communities are disproportionately exposed. So the headline that the U.S. is, fast food is targeting black kids isn't accurate. I think you're right that they're targeting people who typically buy their food, which is people who can't afford to buy expensive food.
Like a family of five, for example, you know, they're probably going to want to visit the Colonel for some chicken rather than constantly have dinner at the Olive Garden.
Right. There was an episode of Penn and Teller Bullshit about this, about fast food and how everyone's like, oh, fast food's bad. It's bad for the health crisis, blah, blah, blah. And he shows families who don't have time and money, and it actually is a benefit to their life to have cheap food available to them to get it when they need it.
I love that episode. That episode had, they recreated, they had like a blind test, a blind study, and they had people eating regular food like from like, I think it was KFC, and like, oh, it's so unhealthy, I just feel so fat. So they took the same food from KFC and recooked it, and they turned it into like a bisque or something, or a salad or something like that, and reserved it to the same people, and the people were like, oh, this is so healthy, I feel so much healthier, I think the food is much richer, and it was the same freaking food!
And someone recently did that with McDonald's, where they just told people it was organic. They literally just chopped up a cheeseburger from McDonald's, put it on a toothpick, and called it organic, and people loved it. But you have to think of this in a broader context, because we're talking about, well, so why are we talking about that they shouldn't be disproportionately targeting these kids? Because of the obesity epidemic, which we hear about constantly. Think about this for a moment. America is so rich that the biggest epidemic among our poor is that they are overfed. Wah fucking wah. Choose to run a little bit, go outside, play in the park. If you've ever seen the movie Fathead, which was the rational response to Super Size Me, where the guy eats McDonald's, the fattiest food he can get at McDonald's, supersized all the time for 30 days and loses weight. Because he's not an idiot. So, get over it. I'm over it. Also, Mayor McCheese is over it.
Officer Big Mac.
Can you imagine getting, tased by Officer Big Mac? That's gotta be an embarrassing moment in your life. But remember, kids, that if you are not getting people to listen to you, especially about childhood obesity or any of your social justice issues, then according to IO9, which is part of the Gawker family, sometimes the best way to change people's minds is outright tyranny. Yes, this is a real article.
Does that say outright Tyrion, like Tyrion Lannister?
Yeah, outright midget.
Sometimes that is the best way to convince people. You're just like, here's Tyrion. And I'm like, yeah, I agree.
I agree.
Right. No. Miss Esther Ingalls Arkell. Why do these people always have almost impronounceable names? Argues that sometimes the best way to change people's minds is outright tyranny. I had to say that again because it's one of the most bizarre headlines I've ever seen, ever. So the headline itself is outrageous, but to be fair, the article isn't about political tyranny per se. It's basically about being a complete dick. Their first point about how you can make people believe you is to be mean to them. Their second point is make everything as public as possible, meaning if someone makes a pledge to do something, make sure they're doing it where other people can see it, so that they feel socially pressured into following through. So the article itself is a little bit boring, but I think the use of the conflation between the headline, Change People's Minds by Using Outright Tyranny, and then this idea of being mean to people and using really subversive, persuasive tactics is very revealing about how the left thinks about these issues. Yeah. And it actually relates to the last story.
You mean they don't respect human beings and they just see them as faceless drones that they can just all treat the exact same way rather than deal with them as individuals and convince them as individuals?
Yes, and. Yes, and. They look at marketing and persuasion as equivalent to force. That there is no difference between force in their head and persuasion. That they are all one form of the same thing. So that they can conflate tyranny with being mean to someone in order to get them to do something.
Well, yeah, that's just a logical consequence of what I just said.
Yes.
But it extends far beyond marketing. I mean, this is why they get mad at Mark Zuckerberg wearing a gray shirt. It's everything you do is that oppression. Because other people are forced to deal with you. Mm-hmm. Therefore, anything you do is force exerted upon them. They're not defining force physically. They're defining force as something that exists that you would prefer it didn't. It just is there, and it's in. And it's actually, you know what it is? It's narcissism. See how I got there?
Nice.
Ooh, work that in. Very nice.
I didn't mean to. That wasn't in my prep or anything. I just, that is the brilliance that you just watch the inner machinations of JML's mind. You listen to the inner machinations of JML's mind.
JML's mind via the sound waves was inside you.
I just raped your mind.
So say the feminists. Mm-hmm. So I don't particularly think that people understand really how bad tyranny is. And I wonder if the author of this article, Esther Ingalls Arkell, I can't pronounce her name, if she would say this to a room of Holocaust survivors, for instance. Because it's completely absurd. And if the left continues to not take tyranny seriously, then we would be on a path to them being completely okay with someone who is tyrannical. And now I say this and I sound like a right-wing Tea Party nut job, but you have people like, was it Gwyneth Paltrow recently, who basically gushed over Obama saying we should basically give him absolute power to do what is right? Mm-hmm. Not in a joking sort of way, but in a I'm completely serious kind of way. I would be okay if this man had absolute power over us. They need to cut that shit out. That's frightening. Stop it. Stop it.
Well, it's ironic.
Bad Gwyneth Paltrow.
Well, I think you could have done that when she named her kid Apple. But that it's ironic because their whole perspective is they're the ones who say that without laws, people will be left to do bad things. Actually, the right and the left say it equally. But, you know, they're big on that about, you know, how bad people are naturally. Yet they want to let someone just do whatever he wants and have complete control. It's completely contradictory to what they believe.
It goes back to what I said about the cult status. To an extent, it is. That is what it is.
Yeah.
It's not even Obama the person. It's the idea. The idea of this political messiah that's going to make everybody equal, that's going to end racial disharmony, and that's going to make everything A-OK. They don't understand that our government, our system of government, is laid out specifically to be a multi-person machine, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word. It's designed to be difficult. We have an amendment process, but that process is difficult. We don't just change the Constitution willy-nilly. There's a reason why we have all these, we have such a deliberative body, precisely so that one person doesn't make all of the decisions, so that they don't have all the power. So people like Gwyneth Paltrow just fail to understand we don't live in a monarchy. We don't live in a system where one person makes a decision.
And one point that Elliot has made in previous podcasts and in our little group chat for this that I want to point out is that there's also this complete missed concept where you can't change someone's mind via force. That's an oxymoron. You change someone's mind via persuasion. Force is the opposite of persuasion. It is you do this whether you want to or not, or I will hurt you in some way.
That's right.
So there is no changing people's minds through tyranny. It's killing people who don't agree with you through tyranny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
changing people's minds requires a free and open society that where you can persuade each other to do certain things.
Yes, that is the objective definition. I agree with you, but this goes back to your earlier point where they equate them. They equate persuasion with force because you're trying to convince somebody to do something that wasn't their own idea. And if it's not their own idea that they originate with, if it doesn't come from their brain, then it's something that's being forced upon them.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, you can even stretch it to a political idea. The failure to understand what rights actually are. The claim that there's a right to education, the right to healthcare, the right to this, the right to that. Well, you know, I think this is kind of the precursor of that. The failure to understand what it is you actually have rights to do and what you don't have rights to do.
Well, we have a right to be through with these dipshits, so please.
Yes, speaking of faceless, do you know who else is faceless? Zombies. We discussed the most recent episode of The Walking Dead in TV with JML. The most recent episode of The Walking Dead was apparently a fan favorite because it focused on fan favorite characters, Daryl and Carol, who everyone is shipping or who everyone loves. We all know the obsession with Daryl that's on the internet. We remember we talked about previously on this podcast, could Daryl possibly be gay? This episode saw them go into Atlanta to try and save Beth, locate where Beth was and save her. But this is another example of the problem that I've talked about a couple of times on the show. It feels like they're stalling. It's like they don't want to make the plot go forward, so they decide, hey, remember how everyone left Atlanta in season one? Well, now here's a reason to go back there, spend a few episodes with just a couple characters, and that way we don't have to have everyone in the show and not explain why what's going on with them. Whereas, even with this episode, last season they did it with Carol where she wasn't around. But for some reason, they felt the need to have flashbacks to what she did over the time she was missing from the show. Now, they were very brief flashbacks. They were like 30 seconds each, which to me makes them even sort of more worthless. You have Carol standing there over the burnt bodies that we know she burned, but they had to show that for some reason. Or they showed when Carol drove away from Rick when Rick told her she couldn't be in the group anymore. And this is all very much beginning to smack of full-blown naturalism, which makes me ask a question. Because I'm watching the episode, and these characters are making choices, right? They decide to go through this door, or they decide to follow the car. So they were in a car, and they were following another car down 85 into Atlanta. Because that's the one, if you've been to Atlanta, that's the one way you can get in via the highway is 85. It's that one stretch. And somehow, magically, the car in front of them didn't see them, even though there are only two cars on the road, but that's a different story. So, you know, they're making all these choices, but it still feels very naturalistic to me. So the question I have for you guys, Daniel and Elliot, is, what's the difference between portraying in art a character choosing and just showing that character reacting? How do those manifest differently? What are your views on that?
So I guess I'll take a stab at it. So one is that a character choosing, you have to visually portray them going through the motions of a plan, gathering evidence, making a decision to do something over an extended period of time. You sort of get this visually, or you try to get it visually. I don't think anyone's figured it out per se in things like House and Sherlock.
Yeah, Sherlock, I think, is really visually doing what you're saying, the Moffat version.
Yeah, yes, the Moffat version. I think they're doing it better than most. Versus a character reacting, which is a character sort of seemingly making a decision, but it comes sort of out of nowhere. It comes from nothing. It can be an emotional reaction, or it can be an epiphany of some sort, or it can be a whim, but it just sort of happens. There's not a lot of build up to it, and it makes no what am I looking for? Cause and effect sense. It just sort of happens.
Okay, so you're placing an emphasis on understanding the character's reasoning, even if it is irrational reasoning. You understand the character's values and what values the character is using as a basis, and you portray that visually.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a rational choice per se, but it has to be a choice made through the process of thinking it through.
Okay.
And so, I mean, it can be a bad choice is what I'm saying. They could choose poorly, but it has to still be something that is portrayed visually as being thought out.
Okay. Elliot, what do you think?
I'll use as an example the movie that I'm currently obsessed with, which is Interstellar, which we talked about last week. The scene that I have in mind is the moment where Coop decides to investigate that binary, that code that he finds in his daughter's room, drifting through the dust. And he arrives at that secret NASA facility where he meets Michael Caine and Anne Hathaway's characters. To me, the reason why that scene stood out for me is because he goes there because he chooses to. He makes the discovery in his daughter's room, and he goes. And because he goes, they recruit him. Rather than having them contact him and have him show up there or them coming to see him, which I think is very typical in a lot of films of this kind. You know, like, I think, you know, oh, this person has a talent that we need. Let's go see him. We'll go visit him, and we'll entice him to come with us. And I think what I really liked is, to me, it wouldn't have been the same story if he hadn't gone and made it happen. So the choice, to me, the difference between a choice and reaction is, if you're going to step outside of the story and look at it from a writer's perspective, I think it has to do with what propels the plot. Is the plot propelled mainly because of the choices that the character makes, and occasionally things happen and they have to choose how they're going to react to certain situations? Or is it predominantly going to be things that happen to characters, like in a lot of disaster movies, and they just make choices within that context, but they're not making choices really before or after that, if that makes any sense at all to you?
It does. Yeah. And I think I'm going to combine the two things you guys said. And I'll toss this back to Daniel because he's seen a lot of The Walking Dead, and I think it has to do with one of his main critiques of The Walking Dead. I think the problem with the show is sometimes it shows that, the characters and why they're making the decisions, and sometimes it doesn't. Things just happen to them. For instance, in this episode, they showed that why Carol was so aggressive and wanted to kill this kid when he shows up right away. But they don't really show why Daryl doesn't want to kill the kid. He just says he's just a kid. Now, that's giving a reason, but visually they go to where Carol used to work or used to be part of, because it was like a battered women's shelter, or just a battered person shelter, because there was stuff for kids there. So you sort of saw her history and why she's become who she is, and they discuss why she's become who she is. But then again, at the end of the episode, she's just hit by a car. So it sort of balances between the two. And I know, Daniel, this is why I'm saying it's similar. It's sort of relevant to your critique. You've said that The Walking Dead does villains better than heroes. Mm-hmm. But in a way, aren't the villains more naturalistic? Because we don't really see them choosing. We just sort of see them kind of pop up and do bad things and then disappear.
But I think that's, I mean, it's not ideal for a villain, but it's sort of acceptable for a villain if the hero is the one who can make the choices. But to integrate sort of what Elliot was saying with what I was saying in regards to The Walking Dead, which I just did now, so you can hear the inner machinations of my mind, I think the particular reason that it seems like naturalism in The Walking Dead and my critique of it is because The Walking Dead doesn't create scenarios where the characters can make a choice long term. They're constantly creating scenarios where the characters must react in the moment. And I think that's partially to do with the apocalypse setting. But like, I was thinking about one of the most recent episodes that I've watched, which shows you how far behind I am, which is the one where Rick is knocked out cold on the couch and Coral is,
So you're still on season four.
maybe I have them in the wrong order, but that's the one I'm thinking of at the moment. No, I've seen the Terminus stuff. So I'm in season five to some degree. Point being, so he's sort of walking around and it's sort of a little bit aimlessly. You don't really see what he's doing. But like the moment he starts to come with a plan for what he's doing, whether it's cathartic or not, it's like he gets caught in a room with a zombie and loses a shoe. And that completely interrupts his entire planning process, and we're back to reacting. So he has some pudding. It's like there's no payoff for that. That's just you putting him in a world where it's impossible for him to make decisions.
And that goes back to the stalling critique, because it feels like they're stalling, but they're not really, because the way they've conceptualized the world is overarching goals aren't possible, which is why there is no overarching goal to the series.
Yeah, yeah. So then, I think it's becoming more and more naturalistic in that sense. It has to.
So then is a prerequisite of romanticism some broader goal that characters are working towards?
That's interesting. While I think through that, I'm going to toss it over to Elliot unfairly.
I will certainly say that the romantic stuff that I'm really into involve people choosing overarching goals. So I kind of think that it is, because if art is all about selection, and you're selecting to a human being, a character, archetype that is volitional, that is moving towards goals, that makes choices, I think that you kind of do need at least something of an overarching goal, even if they don't fully understand it themselves. I mean, the overarching goal of Les Miserables, for example, the theme of the book is man's desire to escape from prisons, particularly the prisons that he builds for himself and his own mind. So, I mean, and even though Valjean never explicitly states that, that is his struggle. That is his unstated goal throughout, from the beginning of the book when he's just a prisoner to the end. So I think you need, even if it's not clear to the character, I think that he does need an overarching goal that will at least be clear to the reader or to the watcher.
Yeah, I think I agree with that overall. I would parse it out more and basically say that you could probably have some very poor form of romanticism where the character is driven by choices but doesn't have an overarching goal. I'm saying that completely hypothetically because I can't actually think of something that does, but I'm not sure that means it couldn't happen. But really, if you're going to do romanticism well, the character absolutely must have some overarching goal that integrates with the theme that drives the plot throughout the entire film. Otherwise, you lose motivation for this character to be making the choices that they're making.
Which I think is sort of the growing weakness of The Walking Dead. It's like, why do we care about whatever they're doing? And that's why it seems like they're just reacting, because it seems just to survive into the next instant.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, right. I mean, I would give that question some more thought, and maybe I'd come back next week and go, no, I was completely wrong. You can't have romanticism without an overarching goal. But
or our listeners can share what they think is the answer to that question. Is an overarching goal?
Fine.
Oh, fine.
Oh, I guess we'll listen to them.
Yeah. What do you think? Is an overarching goal necessary for romanticism?
Yeah.
But let's move on to an article that Elliot shared with us this week. It speaks to the point about the evil being done well in The Walking Dead, Daniel. Elliot, why don't you tell us about this article that's called It's Time to Bring Back the Banality of Evil, which is also, again, by
IO9. Yeah, we gotta stop going to those guys for...
You mean you have to stop going to those guys?
Yeah, I do. They piss me off, like, every day.
They are one of the most... And, okay, so this term absolutely, unequivocally gets thrown out way too much, especially in objectivist circles, but I think they genuinely are the most nihilistic publications out there. And it's creeping, because it used to just be on their Gawker main site. And I used to read IO9 regularly, and it was just science fiction news. And now it's all social justice nonsense wrapped in this science fiction, basically peeled off skin. So, fuck those guys. But let's talk about the article.
Actually, guess who wrote it? Esther Inglis Arkell.
By the way, folks, this was completely coincidental.
That is coincidental.
All right, we need to tweet this episode at her, though. let's get her on the podcast.
Oh, I Esther. Couldn't resist just calling her stupid. Okay, I'll wait.
Wait, before I've even gotten the offer out, you've already called her stupid. Esther, never mind. You don't want to go on this podcast. Never mind, Esther.
It wasn't the stupid part that was going to be controversial. It was the next six words.
Yeah, I figured. That's why I said you don't want to bother coming on. Because she, believe me, I was thinking it and you were thinking it, she was thinking it.
All right. What's the point of this article?
Okay, the whole point of the article basically is, you know, the idea of the genius, refined murderer is becoming a tired trope, and she wants to go back to having commonplace evil, I guess. She talks a lot about this show called The Fall on the BBC. I've never seen it. She talks about Dexter, you know, that. She talks about True Detective. Hannibal is one of the ones that she references a lot. So I guess her whole point is she's tired of the trope of the genius, refined, brilliant murderer. And she just, I guess, wants to go back to the hack 'em up, saw 'em up kind of evil person that I don't know. I don't understand exactly what it is that she's saying.
There are a couple of terrible things here, and there's actually one thing I quasi agree with, though I think it was completely unintentional. So I'll start with that, which is, I think there is some legitimacy to the idea that we need to stop giving so much motivation and background for our bad guys. Like, and I think that it crossed, what's the term?
Jump the shark.
Mm-hmm. Jump the slope. Jump the sea otter. When we got the movie Maleficent from Disney, regardless of whether you like this movie or not, I had no need to know about the evil Queen Maleficent's childhood and why she turned out to be an evil bitch.
Well, that's Wicked's fault.
Yes, absolutely. It's just, she's an evil person. She's a bad guy. That's the end of the line for me. There are no more questions before that. I don't need to know why Ursula is a strangling octopusy.
Because she's fat.
Octopus.
Thank you.
Sorry.
So that's one element, but I think that's minor agreement between us. But the one thing about this article that I just read it and I was like, okay, this entire thing is stupid. She says, I'm not quoting, but she says something to the effect of, all of the shows I'm discussing here are individually great shows, but as a collective, it is a tired theme. Think about that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Who is it? You can't watch these individually great shows and go, oh, great show, great show, great show, great show. Overall, shitty TV. Doesn't work that way.
Well, this is something they commonly do where they judge shows in light of other shows. So they'll look at Boardwalk Empire, they'll look at Breaking Bad, they'll look at Mad Men, and they'll say, oh, well, this only exists because of The Sopranos, and we have to judge it in light of The Sopranos. As if The Sopranos doesn't exist because of some work of literature that came before it and had that type of a hero, right? As if the trope of the anti-hero, main hero character isn't from earlier literature, and it was invented for Tony Soprano.
Like The Godfather never happened kind of thing.
Yeah. I was trying to make a more literary reference than The Godfather, though, because that's also visual art.
I want to make a bold claim here, and you, without thinking it through entirely, and you can tell me whether or not you think this is the case, but here's my bold claim. A trope, in and of itself, cannot be tired collectively. It can only be tired per individual instance, meaning that individual instance was done poorly. But there's no such thing as a trope being collectively tired.
Right. It's about the execution of the individual product. It's not about the trope overall. To sort of tie it to a thing close to home, it would be like if somebody was like, oh, don't do a zombie web series because zombies are played out. No, just because there's a lot of zombies out there and you think they're played out, that just means there's a lot of bad zombie things that are done. That doesn't mean zombies in themselves are a played out trope. It just means it needs to be done well if you're going to do it, but that's true of anything.
Right. Exactly. This is just a mindset that believes that they know this sort of proper standard for what amount of art should be in the culture. oh, we've had enough of zombies now. No more zombies. Now we need to move on to no more vampires. We've had enough of vampires. No more. Shut up.
Yeah, saying zombies are over. Like, who decides that?
If the individual product is delightful, then the individual product is delightful. There is nothing else you can conclude from that about the greater culture of that trope.
The big thing, though, that I take away from this, because she writes even later on when she talks about, you know, according to one review of modern serial killers, and I'm quoting what she's writing, 30% of serial killers are motivated by financial gain. Wouldn't that be interesting? A story about how a killer manages to get away with murder again and again as a way of making a comfortable living. Like, no, that wouldn't be, first of all, no, that wouldn't be fucking interesting. Number one.
A guy who gets away with murder so he can live on a minimum wage salary.
It's ridiculous. This is her, I guess, attempting to apply naturalism to a nihilistic concept, maybe?
Ding, 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 ding. She's complaining about these romantic stories, right? Dexter, romanticism. Hannibal, you won't talk about romanticism. Hannibal is all about the choices Will Graham makes while trying to stop Hannibal, and all about the choices Hannibal makes in order to stop Will Graham from stopping him. And she wants it so you make it uninteresting. Can you imagine Hannibal if Hannibal wasn't a worldly educated psychologist who was well off? He was just like a janitor making minimum wage and Will Graham was trying to stop him. It would be the worst show ever.
It'd be an episode. It'd be a procedural.
Right, it would be an episode of Law and Order. So she just wants to watch SVU over and over again. That's the banality of evil.
It really is. That's actually a good example.
Is it banal? Can we say that evil can actually be, I mean...
That's a greater point.
I mean, that's interesting. So the other point I was going to make about this article is that I actually think that the sophisticated brute is an excellent, what is the word? An excellent evolution in the evil villain, because there are basically two kinds of evil villains: the super smart genius who is typically weak and needs the other kind of evil villain, which is the brute, who is typically stupid.
Damn it, Mimsy.
Right. But modern shows, to much success, have integrated these two villain types into one super villain. And I think that is a really good thing, actually.
I agree. And to close up, I just want to make one point about her proving she doesn't understand what she's watching. She claims in Hannibal that Hannibal is never the worst villain that exists, that there's always some more sick and twisted killer. No, you're not understanding the show if you understand that. The reason they have these other killers is because ultimately Hannibal manipulates them as a chess piece in his game with Will Graham. And that's what makes Hannibal so twisted and worse than everyone else, is he is in complete control of his faculties. He seems rational, whereas these other people are twisted, right? The character she was referencing wanted to feed people to his pigs. Whereas Hannibal seems to be in complete control and know exactly what he's doing, and he has this grand design, right? That's the theme of the series. This is my design. So by saying that there's always someone worse than Hannibal, she is placing emphasis not on the mind, but she's placing it on the pure brutality of the action, which is how you get towards, Elliot, what you were saying, the sort of more naturalistic approach to this. And Daniel, exactly what you were just saying, she's putting the emphasis on the brute side of it.
Mm-hmm. Which is fine. There's room for that. But I think this is a superior form of villain if you're going to have a superior form of hero to equal it.
Right. Would Zod have been as compelling as a villain for Superman if he was just a brute? No, what made Zod so compelling was he actually thought through what he was doing and had a greater goal he was working towards.
Yes.
Speaking of faceless questions and comments, let's provide some Yahoo Answers answers. Just another answer, I won't begin. Just another question. First question. So this question sort of goes with our Obamacare anonymous users news article.
Sweet.
What's with all the faceless avatars? Why do they always ask the weirdest or worthless questions? Grammar again. So they're asking about the faceless avatars on Yahoo Answers. This is how they explain it. Why are there so many faceless avatars? Like, it only takes a minute at most to choose a face. If only that were true. Heck, if you're paranoid about privacy, it doesn't even have to look like you, question mark. And why do the weirdest, perverted, disgusting, or worthless questions always seem to come from some faceless level one, question mark. Damn those level ones.
I mean, I think there's been a lot of psychological studies of the internet around this topic because it's quite prevalent. Although I think even prior to the internet, people wrote anonymous letters to the editor and anonymous, you know, posts on boards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, I really think it is a form of narcissism in a certain degree. Now that sounds weird saying, how is it narcissism if they don't want to have a face? But it's narcissism in the sense of, I want to be able to say whatever I want to anyone I want without any consequence whatsoever. Because I am that important. And the internet allows them to do that.
Mm-hmm. It's the anonymity. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. Justin, I know you have strong feelings about this, so.
Well, I actually want to put forward an idea here. Did you see the most recent episode of South Park? They did the freemium games thing. No, it was 2 weeks ago. Sorry, the most recent was the VR one. Did you see the one where they did the freemium games thing?
No, I haven't yet.
Oh, well, they did freemium games, and their point was it was essentially just creating these games to get addicts to give them money in the same way gambling does. They were making that comparison. And I was thinking about it in general, and these people who do this with the multiple accounts and the anonymity, isn't there a certain level of addiction to this? And you know, you say it's narcissism, okay, maybe it's narcissism, but isn't this filling this need, this psychological need they have, rather than having them deal with reality and actually being productive, that the internet is substituting and acting as sort of a drug in that way?
Like a power trip, but like on crack kind of thing?
Yes, like a power trip on crack. The internet is a power trip on crack.
Yeah, I mean, it is to a certain degree. And certainly, I sort of know what that episode was about, which is the idea that gamification of things triggers a certain response in your brain, which legitimately gives you like endorphins and makes you feel good. So it is in essence sort of like a drug when you do those things.
Right. And people are essentially, they were targeting, it went one step beyond that. They're saying that the companies are targeting the people who are most susceptible to that. So Stan found out that the reason he was so addicted to the game, whereas other people weren't, was he was genetically predisposed for that. So they were only really making money off of a small group of people, which this is how it links to the Obamacare article. And the same thing with the internet is, going back to the Michael Bay comment, is the small group of 50 people just the 50 people who are most predisposed towards this sort of behavior?
So I wouldn't go with predisposed. Okay, well, I'll backtrack a little. I'm not entirely sure it's the predisposed thing, and that would take a more scientific, rigorous study to figure that out. What I would say for sure is that these type of gamification things really work well on people who don't have very high self-esteem. And that's completely proven. I've read a lot about it, especially at Clemson. But because the idea is that these gamification mechanisms act as an achievement in reality. So when I act as a substitute for an achievement in reality. So when I get 100,000 points on said game, that is an achievement that triggers the same parts of my brain that would happen if I built a birdhouse. But it's much easier to do. So it's, even though there's a lot less of that, since it's easier to do, you can get it in equal quantities. So people
right,
who have particularly low self-esteem will do it over and over again repetitively.
Right, and same thing with commenting on the Obamacare website over and over again.
Yeah, and there are things about that. So like on Facebook, you can be named a top commenter and your comments can be liked and shared.
What do you mean? You're going to comment five times to be a top commenter. Sorry, people, if that's how you're tying up your identity, it's really easy to get that.
I know, but that's part of the gamification of it. But even before that, Justin, the whole idea of setting up an account is gamified to give you a reward for that sort of thing. You go through step by step, and Facebook gives you pluses for adding a picture and adding a comment and sharing a status.
Yeah, the
it's
percentage
all gamified.
Bar, the percentage, like on LinkedIn, they're always like, your profile is only 86% complete. And I'm like, no, I have everything I want on my profile, thank you. But it's always up there. 86% or whatever it is.
Right. Now, if you look at my LinkedIn profile, which is obsessively filled out because I'm a digital media person, it's 95% filled out. And that's because LinkedIn never wants you to feel like you're finished.
this goes back to what I was saying about with the Obamacare article. We haven't learned to deal with the internet. Are we just letting this powerful communication tool, this powerful information tool, be used to target a select group of people who can't cope with it properly? Because that's the way to create the most quote-unquote internet money.
Yeah, I mean, this is really dangerous. I think someone needs to be regulating this.
Yeah, that's totally what I was saying. But if it's not the government regulating it, maybe it's our next question. Anonymous, question mark. What's your view on the internet vigilante group, Anonymous? And I'm going to add this little tag. Does it have anything to do with what we were talking about with the previous question?
Interesting. I'm going to let Elliot jump in here because I feel like I've been monopolizing the time.
No, I've been letting you monopolize because I'm out of my depth on a lot of this.
Are you familiar with Anonymous?
I'm vaguely familiar. I don't know how to feel about them, to be honest with you. Anonymous. I like the idea of people being people on the internet to fight back against things like government tyranny. I think you'd be more effective, like in North Korea, for example, or in Cuba or China, where, you know, have them really work to tear down those kind of oppressive governments. But I don't really know how to feel about them. I really don't.
So, yes, to some degree, and no, to a lot of degree. The thing about Anonymous is that they are like all vigilantes, meaning there are things that they do that you go, oh, yeah. Like pointing out where pedophiles live by trapping them on the internet and then pointing out this guy just downloaded a bunch of child porn pictures. Like, I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that because they haven't done anything illegal. But on the other side of it, they do things that are illegal and that they should not be allowed to do, like hack into bank accounts of those same child molesters and zero them, or steal bitcoins from Ku Klux Klan groups online, stuff like that. Those are shitty people and shitty groups, but this group of people should not be the ones taking that into their own hands. It's dangerous because there's going to come a time where they're going after someone for just an ideological difference that has nothing to do with the law.
So I have a question.
I think you'll probably see that in the environmental realm, but go ahead.
This is what it seems to me Anonymous is. It seems to me that this is what the people on Reddit do, but they just didn't want to be caught, so they just covered up all their tracks and called themselves Anonymous. What's the difference between Redditors doing this to people and the group Anonymous?
Well, I mean, I think to some degree, the Redditors are less technologically sophisticated. So the Anonymous group like to hack government websites and bank accounts and things like that. Whereas Redditors are more sort of about social justice in the more exact meaning of that word. So basically like putting up people's profiles and publicly shaming them, or calling for mass boycott action of the Clippers or whatever it is. So I think the one difference is that Anonymous is potentially more dangerous, if maybe less morally bankrupt, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I mean, you've sort of explicated my feelings on Anonymous, which is why I put this question in here, because I'm always sort of confused about who they are. I always hear about them and then it's like, I know that's the point, but no, I just, you know, I don't know what their mission is. I don't know what their goal is. It just seems to be like to dick over anyone they don't like is basically what it is.
That's one of the more frightening things. They have no integrating principles per se. They're just out to get the bad guys.
Right.
Bad guys meaning anyone they disagree with.
Right. It's sort of like the purge on the internet.
Kind of is. It's actually not a bad metaphor.
All right. Next question. This one's a doozy. And I picked it because Yahoo Answers, there's always this battle going on between religious people and atheism. And both sides just say the most ridiculous things. And this is one of them. Is atheism an enemy of freedom? Now, this is their explanation. The argument is often made that because religion has been a factor, a justification, if you will, to sell wars to the masses, even though they were much more about strategic land grabs and started over control of trade routes, and because it has also been abused in times of fear when panic-stricken, ethnocentric people thought purging their land from those different from them would solve everything, religion must be evil and that atheism must be the way to go. By the way, if you understood that paragraph, good for you. I disagree. Atheism stands on the absence of ideals so foundation to our way of life that it can only be a threat, and historical precedent backs this up.
Really?
Freedom and equality rests on there being intrinsic, it's not repeated, I'm just repeating that word because I think that's an important word here, value in all human life. That our worth is not demonstrated by wealth or social class or race, gender, any of it. That we are equal. Atheism has no basis for this. Nothing is eternal. So let that sit for a second. Nothing is of value outside of its weight in gold, so to speak. There is no absolute morality either. Not that atheists don't have morals, they just write their own rules. Which is why they think they are free to insult, hate, belittle, and in every known case where an officially atheist political system has risen, imprison and murder anyone and everyone who disagrees with them. Because the only people who are really free under an atheist ideology are those who have clawed their way to the top where they get to oppress everyone else. Classic social Darwinism.
That's some package dealing right there.
Okay. Oh, that's a giant package.
And not in a good way.
Not the good kind. Right out. Yeah. Thanks, Elliot. Where do we begin? Is not masturbating a threat to sex? Is not skiing a threat to sports? Is not reading a threat to literacy? Okay, that one might be a little.
That could be. But
the point is, the absence of something is not a something. That's the very first thing we need to get the fuck into our heads right now. Not skiing is not a sport. It's not. It's a nothing. So atheism, the lack of belief in God, is not a belief. It's the lack of one. Thank you. Elliot, please.
I think that there's so much here. Let me put it this way. Both Richard Dawkins and Ayn Rand were atheists. Okay, but you would not ever think that they have the same ideology or the same philosophy. They don't. They're distinct. Atheism is simply a part of one's metaphysical view. Because it is possible to not believe in God, but still believe in, like, multiverse quantum physics where there's multiple universes and stuff like that. There are people, I know atheists out there who believe that. They believe in energies and things like that that can be manipulated through hand movements and stuff. You know, it's very possible to be an atheist and still have those views. Now, I would find them to be contradictory, but many people seem not to for some reason. It's just one part of a person's philosophy. To say that atheism is automatically going to lead to imprisonment and torture and then try to use the Soviet Union or to use the Nazi Germany as an example of that is to completely drop the philosophical context, which is statism, which is the use and the initiation of force. The fact that a person does not believe in God does not mean that they subscribe to objective reality. It does not mean that they uphold reason as man's means of gaining knowledge and as his ultimate means of survival. It's not the same thing. To say that a society can fall apart because it might be because of its atheists, you know, or because it has atheist leadership or because people might predominantly be atheists is to completely drop the context of what a person holds philosophically, because ultimately you're describing one part of one of the foundational tenets of a philosophy.
Unfortunately, your example of Richard Dawkins and Ayn Rand having different ideologies is only going to support their point in their mind, because they'll say, see, you're saying that there are no foundational principles of atheism.
But the foundational
principles. Was that what I said? That
foundational.
No, I'm not saying you said that. I'm saying that's what they're going to say, because they're taking all their morality from their belief in God. God exists, therefore people are equal. It's not people are equal.
Well, the whole point is that and when you come to a philosophy, there's metaphysics and there's epistemology. Atheism is one part of, is a significant part, but a part of one's metaphysics. A belief or a disbelief in God does not mean a subscription to objective reality. It is possible to disbelieve in the existence of a God and also to be like Marx or to be, I don't think Kant was identified as an atheist, but certainly a lot of people who subscribe to his philosophy are. But I don't think they go together.
Even the religionist person here would be dropping context as well. The foundational principles of religion, which one? Which one of the thousands of religions that has existed? If religion was such a foundational principle that was innate to human beings, wouldn't we all have the same fucking one?
But their response is going to be, they may be different, but at least each religion has its own foundational principles. Atheism does not.
They're all different! No, but either, it's in the same way that, did we need God to discover mathematics? No. Did we need God to discover physics? No. So do we need God to discover morals or ethics? No. It's all the scientific application of the mind to a given area of life. So we don't need God for that sort of thing. In fact, it just confuses it. But the other element of it, which I really love, is this whole, you know, atheism is not part of our long tradition of civilization. Neither were antibiotics. Neither was a car or an airplane.
Neither was democracy or capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. So we create new things all the time that don't fit into our, quote, foundational or traditional human civilization.
I think
and
we
that's
should
a
bring
good
back,
thing.
I think we should bring back apothecaries.
There's actually one somewhere. Austin? I think I saw one in Austin. I mean, it's just a cute name. I think it's a makeup store or something now.
You know, there's an apothecary at Disney's Hollywood Studios. It's a candy shop.
Apothecaries and haberdasheries.
Mm. All right, now for something completely different. Would you rather zombies or aliens? Now, this is an official Yahoo Answers question that was posted by the site. And there's a whole explanation and blah, blah, blah. But the basic thrust of this is, in an apocalypse, what would you rather deal with? An alien invasion or zombies? So basically, would you rather be on Falling Skies or The Walking Dead? Go.
Well, this is dumb, but that's our show. So, zombies, I think it's clear, isn't it? I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but zombies seem to be a much less formidable foe than a super advanced alien race that has traveled through galaxies to get here. Seems like they would have the superior firepower and the advantage over lumbering things that you just need to be shot in the head once.
Elliot?
I'm torn, actually. I would love to deal with aliens because I think, like, we could learn a lot from aliens. Like, if you're fighting them, like, you manage to get off a good shot, kill one, you could get one of their weapons and learn from it, and I don't know, man. It'd be kind of cool.
You had about 15 minutes before the entire planet is annihilated by some super laser from a Death Star.
I don't know. I kind of want to deal with aliens.
I mean, he did give you a counterpoint. So with an alien invasion, there's more potential for human society to improve if they survive. Whereas in a zombie apocalypse, you're just going to have to rebuild, so it sort of resets society.
I mean, even if it was the zombie apocalypse in The Walking Dead, where dead people, no matter how they die, turn into zombies, I think we could honestly adapt to that as a culture. And it would suck, but we could figure it out.
Well, yeah, and that goes back to one of the problems with The Walking Dead we were talking about with the lack of an overarching goal is you think at some point they try to figure out how to deal with this and live in this world. Instead, they're more worried about killing each other.
Right. Exactly.
Zombies, aliens, none of it matters. We all know that the apocalypse is going to be started by social justice warriors. Find out what their latest cause was in the non-crisis of the week.
one small shirt for a man, one giant leap backward for women. At least that's according to Glenn Harlan Reynolds, blogger at Instapundit and columnist at USA Today. If any of you are following the news this week, then you'll know that we landed a fucking rocket on a comet.
Woo!
That's right. Humans shot a rocket off of our planet, and then hundreds of thousands of miles and years later, we landed on a comet to find out that it smelled like cat piss. That's right. But no, this achievement of humankind could not just be held up as a glorious moment for our civilization. It had to be held up as a moment of horrifying patriarchy. Scientist Matt Taylor, who is part of the comet landing team, was interviewed on his accomplishment, but then someone noticed he was wearing a shirt made for him by a female friend featuring comic book depictions of semi-naked women. And according to Mr. Reynolds, suddenly the triumph of the comet landing was drowned out by shouts of feminist outrage about what people were wearing. That's right. These people who want us to think that they can be seriously involved in science and not just focus constantly on clothing, makeup, and hair were pissed about this guy's shirt. There is some irony here.
Isn't that the same thing as the Zuckerberg thing?
Yes! It is the exact same thing as the Zuckerberg thing. So you go from this guy wearing a shirt with naked women on it to Zuckerberg wearing a plain gray t-shirt and nothing is acceptable. Nothing. It's amazing. So the Atlantic's Rose Eveleth tweeted, no, women are totally welcome in our community. Just ask the dude in this shirt. Astrophysicist Katie Mack commented, I don't care what scientists wear, but a shirt featuring a woman in lingerie isn't appropriate for a broadcast if you care about women in STEM, which is science and technology, engineering, and mathematics, for anyone wondering.
Now, you could argue it wasn't an appropriate shirt, but it's the second clause with the if that's the issue, correct?
Correct. You could say you probably shouldn't have worn that for broadcast, but that's not what they were worried about.
Mainly because it probably made it really difficult for the camera operator and the lighting guy to adjust for your gaudy shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to wear anything with lines or with complicated patterns, certainly.
And with a variety of colors like that.
So thus was born Shirtgate, as women all over the Huffington Post and other depths of the internet were outraged that despite the fact we landed a giant rocket on a comet, that this guy had the audacity to wear a shirt made for him by a female friend with women comic book characters on it.
Wait, I didn't even realize that there were women comic book characters on it?
That's what they were. They were semi-naked female comic book characters.
Like pin-up women, you know, like from a pin-up calendar. It was that style.
Oh, so it wasn't like Rogue and Storm and Black Widow.
No.
But they were from comic books, but they wasn't famous people. So to shirt or not to shirt, that is the question. What say you both?
Whatever. That's what I say. I don't care about any of this.
the fact that they made the poor guy apologize the next day, and it was a tear-filled apology, like he was sobbing. He felt so bad at his role in the patriarchy, and I just wanted to reach through the screen and alternately console him.
I don't think we want to know what you wanted to do when you reached through the screen.
I wanted to reach through my computer screen and console him and slap him. I'm like, what are you doing?
You're into some really kinky shit, Elliot.
Well, yeah, but that's besides the point. No, but it just, this is so... This is exactly what Ayn Rand wrote about, and I made this parallel earlier when she was talking about Apollo 11 in 69, and Pablo Picasso's reaction was, it has nothing to do with me, I don't care, it means nothing to me. I mean, it kind of feels like that, it's that same thing. These women, they don't care what this achievement was. What matters is their little slice of, you know, attention and of media. I mean, it's just abhorrent. Emphasis
one
on
final. Oh, hate mail to Elliot this week. So one final question for you both. Is it time to beat up the female bullies?
Well, I don't think that should be limited to female bullies. I mean, we're going to start looking like these MRAs or these red pills or whatever the crap you want to call them. I think this goes to bullying, and I think Elliot brings up a great point when he talks about the guy crying. We always talk about social pressure and how this is all just bullying tactics. And I think the guy being brought to tears so he apologizes it demonstrates that that's what they're doing. If you look at it, he felt bad because he wasn't intending any of this, but he was told he made people feel bad, so that genuinely made him feel bad because he's a good person, so he cried over it. That's what that is. So what they've done is they've used his own benevolence against him to push their agenda through, and that is nothing but peer pressure. And I think it's because this guy probably hasn't had to deal with much of it, so he doesn't know how to cope with it and identify the manipulation tactics when they're being used on him, when the screws are being put on him, when the screws are being turned. He's never really had to deal with that, so I would guess he's never really had to deal with that. So this is what happens. This is his reaction. And that's who they prey on. Like bullies, they prey on the weak, the people without coping mechanisms.
And I would add to that also, I mean, this guy has probably been working around the clock on this mission, you know, probably going, spending very little time at home, probably no social life to speak of. You know, he's probably been dedicating a lot of his time and his life to this work.
Well, if he has a female friend making him shirts, I doubt he's married.
But you know what I mean. Like, but I think that he is, I mean, he's dedicated so much of his time to this, you know, and time is such a limited thing that we all have. The idea that his moment in the sun, the moment where he really should have been proud, was robbed from him over something so stupid as a shirt, that is just offensive on so many levels.
Is it time to bring back an older Rush Limbaugh phrase? I don't remember when he used to call these people feminazis.
This hasn't gone away.
He was way ahead of his time when he said that. Ahead of his time.
Yeah, absolutely. If there's any silver lining to this story, it's that the maker of his shirt, which is a small Etsy store, I believe, or something like that, they are sold out of them now.
Yes, at $60 a pop. Go, girl, get it. She was proud of that work, too.
All right. What did we learn this week?
I learned that Ronald McDonald is a crypt, but that Mayor McCheese is the better gangster name.
Also, you learned about Officer Big Mac.
It's true. I did really honestly learn about Officer Big Mac.
Elliot?
I learned that gray t-shirts are sexist.
But not black mesh t-shirts.
And black mesh? No, no. Low-cut V-necks? No, they're not sexist.
Yeah, I think Elliot likes those.
Oh, yeah.
What did you learn, Justin?
Well, I wouldn't say I learned something specifically, but I think I better concretize the idea of a need for an overarching goal in a story for it to be romantic, where you have something that you know the characters are working towards or you know the story is building towards. When we were having the discussion, it made me think of Joss Whedon and how he always had his, especially in Buffy, he always had his big bad, so you knew where it was sort of building towards.
Yeah, makes sense. And if you learned something this week, why don't you give us a shout out on Twitter and let us know at the Midside. Or if you're so inclined, you've all been giving us such lovely 5-star ratings on iTunes that I have a new assignment for you this week in the shill segment. Why don't you personally share our podcast with one? Yes, I said it. One friend. Just reach out to them via Snapchat or Grindr or whatever your preferred method of hooking up is and just say, hey, this podcast is awesome, and I thought you in particular would love it. And that's how we grow our army here.
Does any of our audience use Snapchat?
I don't. I assume people use it. I don't ever open the damn thing.
Yeah, I've never used it in my life, so I don't even know how it works.
The ghost scares me.
Well, no, what scares me about Snapchat is there's no way it's ephemeral and just disappears.
Oh,
no
it
way.
Absolutely doesn't. Where's absolutely that? Not.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day!
But that's the point.
Yeah, I know.
Is this?
That's exactly the point.